But what I'm going to concentrate on mostly is what's going on with the particle experiments as they relate to the standard model. I thought I'd pick three examples of projects that are being worked on in Canada that are projects, as you'll see, that form part of the IPP program. Babar at the Slack B factory, CDF at the Tevatron, and Atlas, the future project at the CERN Large Hadron Collider. And if there's time at the end, I'll tell you a little bit about where particle physics in Canada is headed. There was a question about what this is. This is our logo with l'Institut de Physique de Particules in Canada, or the Canadian Institute of Particle Physics, so you can read it any way around, and it still makes sense in both official languages. So what is the Institute of Particle Physics? This is the other answer to that question. It was actually founded almost 33 years ago, and so that diagram would probably have been more familiar to the particle physicists 30 years ago than it is now. I think it has something to do with the way the quarks form into mesons. And it was founded to coordinate, support, and to promote particle physics research in Canada. Our main activity now is that we operate a research scientist program. I'll tell you a little bit more about that on one of the next slides. But we also spend a lot of time sort of trying to maintain a long-term view of what's going on in particle physics in the world, and hence what should or shouldn't be done in Canada, and optimize our participation in these big international collaborations that it takes to do particle physics. No, that's not me. We're actually a nonprofit corporation. We're run by institutional members. The Perimeter Institute is one, so of many. I'll show you those in a minute. There's a director, that's me, and we have six elected council members that establish the scientific program, and then there's a board of trustees who make sure that I don't embezzle all the money. And we're funded by an NSERC project grant. We have actually about 150 individual members from 24 different Canadian institutions. 14 are institutional members, as they say, including this one here. But I think there's only three or four individual members from here, so more are always welcome. And these are the elected council members currently, including Cliff. So it's his fault that I'm here. And as I say, our main academic activity is this IPP Research Scientist Program. There are these eight gentlemen, we had one woman retire actually 2 or 3 years ago, who are IPP scientists currently. These are the years that they started in their position as IPP scientists. So you can see it's not just a sort of postdoc program, but we have a number of scientists who've been around with the Institute for 20 or more years since its foundation. In fact, as they say, Penny Estabrooks from Carleton retired 2 or 3 years ago out of an IPP scientist position. The idea is that these are in all ways equivalent to faculty positions at Canadian universities, except that there's no teaching responsibility, and so these allow these people the time to spend time at the lab that's necessary in working in these large collaborations to support the efforts of other faculty and graduate students who work at Canadian institutions. These are the projects they work on. I'll say a little bit more about the IPP projects, but you can see some of the ones I'm going to talk about today, some other famous Canadian experiments that I won't spend time talking about today. And these are some of the things that they're looking towards the future to work on in the coming years. About a third of our membership are actually theorists as well. In fact, when it was founded in the 1970s, it was founded by some of the first particle theorists in Canada, because they looked around and they found there were no experimentalists working in Canada, and they didn't quite know why that was. Clearly, there were lots of nuclear experimentalists, and many of them switched over. But in order to foster this change of direction in the early 1970s towards particle physicists, they thought it was a good idea to found the Institute. As I said, currently about a third of our members are still come from the theory community, and we don't have theory IPP scientists. The whole idea was to have them available to go to the lab. Fortunately, the Perimeter Institute came in to pick up some of the slack there. But we do support workshops, and the whole fostering of the community includes theory as well. Clearly, the field of subatomic physics requires an interplay between theory and experiment. So we're fairly keenly aware of that, and interested in doing what we can to continue to foster and build these stronger ties. And there is really a whole new generation of theorists with the faculty renewal that's going on in Canada now, and the advent of things like the Perimeter Institute. A whole new generation of theorists that are joining the community in Canada. And so over the last couple of years, we've put together a sort of added dimension to the IPP program, or at least we've proposed an added dimension to the IPP program. We established a subcommittee. He wasn't a theorist. In fact, he was my predecessor as director of the IPP, but a subcommittee of theorists to try to understand what the IPP could do to perhaps further foster the theory community in Canada. And one of the things is that we've recognized, and it's been recognized in a number of circles, is that the funding that NSERC is able to provide for theorists doesn't really allow them to hire a postdoc every year. It requires some sort of pooling of their funds. The average grants are, as you can see, not a postdoc salary per year. And so what we've proposed is a way of trying to improve their the financial competitiveness of theorists in the Canadian community by allowing them to apply for matching support for theory postdocs. So they have to have an NSERC grant or some source of funds to do most of the salary. But at some level, we would then entertain proposals for potential promising theorists from members of the IPP, identify the most promising sort of three per year, and offer them 2 years worth of matching funds. This proposal was made to NSERC last fall and was adjudicated 2 weeks ago, but they don't tell anyone the answers in Ottawa until the end of March. So I don't quite know where this is going to end up, but hopefully you'll hear more about it when and if it gets funded. So just before I go on and talk about some specific experiments that people are involved in Canada, I just wanted to sort of give you a sense of the scope or the breadth of what's going on in particle physics in Canada. These are the projects that people are currently working on. I'm going to tell you about the first three, although not quite in that order. Snow, I'm sure you're all familiar with. There's a large and growing group of people working on the neutrino beam experiment in Japan. T2K, Tokai, is the new accelerator facility in Japan, Takami Okanda, and we'll start taking data towards the end of the decade. We have a small group of particle astrophysicists at McGill, principally, and there are still people working on suits. You can see when these various things are going to end, and this gives you some sense of the number of Canadian investigators that are either involved in the project or spending full time on it. So you can see some of them, full time is almost equivalent to the number involved. Others that are just getting started have a somewhat smaller fraction of people. But the kinds of things we worry about is this a broad enough program to serve the whole community? And it seems roughly it is. There are about 70 FTE numbers. There are maybe 90 or 95 people signed up as IPP members, so that's probably fine for the experimental FTEs. And I told you a few minutes ago about what we were trying to do to further our ties with the theorists. Then the question is, are they all viable? I think most of them are. Zeus, CDF, perhaps Babar somewhat later, are going to draw to a close, and I'll say a few words at the end about where these things might be going. But what I wanted to do for the most of the time here today was tell you a little bit about three projects we have been involved in for a number of years. Babar at the Bee Factory, CDF at the Tevatron, and then Atlas. We've been involved for a number of years, although we're still a few years away from taking first data. So what's going on in the Babar Bee Factory experiment? This is just a photograph of the apparatus. It looks very much like any other high-energy physics collider experiment, except perhaps there's a person there. You can see it's sort of a three-story high apparatus. Canadians were actually founding members of the experiment in the early 1990s. The wire drift chamber that you can just sort of see behind that circular hole was actually strung and assembled and tested at Triumph. So this was a major Canadian contribution to the experiment. The original goal was to accumulate something like 100 million epsilon 4s candidates and their corresponding BB bar decay daughters. And they've actually gotten much further than that. Each femtobarn of data gives you about 1 million epsilon 4s's. So they've already got 2 or 2.5 times their original goal, and their prospects for doubling this at least a couple more times. These 100 million epsilon 4s's would allow them to pin down CP violation in B-meson decay, and this just sort of shows you how they've accumulated data. This was the design performance they thought they'd have to run here for 4 or 5 years to get that, and you can see for the first couple of years they're feeling pretty good, but as I'll talk about in a little while, competition has forced them to think even bigger, and you can see now the luminosity is really taking off, and presumably, as I say, they'll end up with close to a billion of these things before they're done. What was the experiment designed to do? It was to measure this angle of the so-called CKM triangle. These are the elements of the four parameters, two of the four parameters in the 3x3 unitary matrix that determines how quarks, behaved in weak interactions. And by measuring B0 and B0 bar mesons decaying into J-psi-K short final states, you can see B0s and B0 bars do it in a slightly different way. This is the time between these decays, and so B0s will tend to live slightly longer and B0 bars slightly less long. If you take the difference over the sum of these, you see a clear sinusoidal oscillation. As I say, this is based on almost 2.5 times the data that they thought they would need, and so now you can see there's an unambiguous measurement of this angle. It's not exactly a measurement of beta, and so there are a few other possible solutions to sine 2 beta. But certainly there's a precision range over which you can allow this angle to vary. And it's now down at the 5% level. And there's still further room for improvement. Now, if that was all that this could do, then it probably wouldn't run it for another factor of 4 or 5. But there are other things that people have started to look into. So apart from this simple J-psi-K short mode, there are a whole slew of other modes. I don't expect you to go through and pull out all of these and understand them in detail. I'm not sure even I understand them all in detail. But each of these different processes, in principle, should also give you a measurement of sine to beta. So you should be able to measure the same angle from each of these decays, or the same CPA symmetry from each of these decays. But you can see many of them are quite complicated. There are these things that are so-called penguin diagrams. This penguin is snoozing or something lying on its side here. But you can see as particles run around in these loops, in principle, there could be other things besides the standard model charge W boson. You could have a charge H from some supersymmetric extension to the standard model. And so it could turn out that the phase advances, the CP phase differences in these diagrams might differ from those of the standard model. And so by studying these more complicated final states, and by comparing the results you get to the result you get from the very clean J-psi-K short case, you can see whether there's any evidence that these phases are different, i.e. whether there's any evidence that other particles are running around in these loops. And you can see, at least in this slide, they've graded them in terms of ones that have the least theoretical uncertainty to ones that have higher theoretical uncertainty.
So what's the latest
on the 5H? So here it is up on the slide next. So indeed, what you see on this is a sort of number of different compilation of all the various different things. This was from the IJEP meeting last summer. I haven't heard. I was actually at Lake Louise the day before yesterday. I don't think there were any of these that were new, but maybe for Morion de la Tuile in the next month. But what's shown here in green is this 5%, this fantastic 5% precision on the golden J-psi K short mode. And then if you look at all of these others, what people first notice is that if you just go ahead and take the naive average, you end up getting something that's significantly lower. It's something like 3.5 sigma lower. Of course, they're not all the same as those diagrams on the previous slide try to explain to you. Some of them have larger theoretical errors and so on. That's not taken into account in averaging all of these different things. But what people have done is that, what's that?
Which something is that?
Which something what?
What is the horizontal axis?
The horizontal axis is a measurement of sine 2 beta. I'm sorry, this is the sine 2 beta is 0.73 something. And if you take these other modes, it's 0.45. So, but given the uncertainties here, it's still 3 sigma or a little bit more than 3 sigma. But again, many of the different modes might have different theoretical uncertainties, so this yellow band is perhaps an aggressive way of looking at this. But that having been said, the groups, both the Bavar experiment and their competitors in Japan, are going to take 2, 4, and maybe 10 times as much data as they have now, and will presumably allow us to pin some of these things down. And indeed, as Maxim would say, there are lots of speculation about whether the two experiments agree or the two experiments disagree and whether you should be averaging those things. I think it's a little bit too early to say too much about those things. There was a question about whether you just took this one point out of the average, but that was answered quite succinctly. It doesn't affect things at all because it has...
So what's the difference between the blue and the black?
The blue and the black are the two competing experiments. The blue ones are the Bavar measurements, and the black are measured in Japan. And so if there's some CPA symmetry between which side of the Pacific you're on, you might worry. But I think it's still safe to say that that's consistent with the errors. Yeah?
Just some basic questions. What is CPA? What is CPA?
CPA.
Thanks.
Is that Canadian?
No. Sorry. This is the CP violation.
Yeah.
The difference between B0 and B0 bar, okay, do you understand that? I don't think there's anything more detailed than that, sorry. CPL, is it written on one of my slides? It may be written on one of the things that I stole. Yeah. Okay.
And if this is detection of another particle, could one particle be responsible for the other particle?
Indeed, that's what this is designed to warn you, is that it could be different things in different channels. So that yellow average that I have on the next slide is all six of these combined. And there could be just a new particle in one of these six diagrams that would affect one category of these measurements and not the others. So you want to be a little bit careful about just averaging them all together in order to generate this 2 or 3 sigma effect. Depending on what it is. And as I'll say later in the talk, this isn't a way to find out what it is. This is just a way to find out if something may be lurking there if we need to go investigate or further. Yeah. Well, again, you know, by me, not at all. But these are the sort of purported theoretical uncertainties in each of the different classes of categories. And so, yeah, it's not 5%. Well, maybe it's 5% by these guys on the top, but it's certainly not 5% averaged over all of them. And the difference is only 40 or 50%. So there is a 10 or 15% theoretical uncertainty that you should be adding to the difference between these two lines.
So those lines don't include the theoretical uncertainty?
No, these are just the experimental uncertainties on measuring this thing. After that, it's left up to the theorists to try to do some more complicated averaging, but that's just an equal weighted average.
So it all the way ended up to like the 2 line to school to the new one.
Absolutely.
Some sort of an
absolutely. Absolutely. No, as I said, that's why I've got two more experiments to tell you about it. This is a place to start. Okay. Let me just tell you a little bit about their future prospects. I saw this nice graph at the NSERC review of particle physics projects in early January, so I couldn't resist stealing it. This just sort of gives you a sense of how active the researchers are. There are sort of 500 people on each of these two experiments, and they're in a continual war, not only to get as much luminosity as one another, but to get as many publications as one another. And you can see they're publishing 50 or 60 papers a year. Not all of them are on CP violation, and not all of them are in these channels, but there are certainly huge numbers of people that are pouring over this data set. This shows you where they are now. Unfortunately, Bavar has been in an extended shutdown. They had an accident at Slack in October where a technician tried to electrocute himself. He's fine now, but the DOE has thrown the book at them. They hope to start taking data again in the next few weeks. The Japanese experiment just keeps going, but I think it's clear that Bavar will lag behind for some period of time now. But ultimately, you can see by 2 or 3 years from now, they expect to get something like 4 to 8 times as much data as they have already. And indeed, until recently, there was a lot of talk of a super B factory that would have 10 times as much luminosity and eventually 10 times as much data. That may be, at least the Americans' interest in that seems to have gone away with their most recent budget, but there may still be some hope of that happening in Japan. And this just shows you what this measurement of beta and the constraint on sine 2 beta gives you relative to a whole slew of other measurements that you make in heavy quark physics, even strange quark physics from K-on CP violation. And you can see by far away, actually, this is the most precise determination. So many of these other things we hope to have input over the next few years, but there's only so much you can do, I think it's fair to say. You won't be able to tell what it is that's causing problems here. Yeah. No, they're working on all of these other things, alpha and gamma, and they're making the measurements of the data for VUB, but they're really strongly theoretically limited.
I thought alpha was measured from the other.
Yeah, with sort of 50% uncertainties at this stage.
Wow. Still,
it's somewhere between 45 and 135 degrees. So even compared to these large swaths. It's hard to draw that.
Did you say the project at Fermilab might be canceled?
The Super B factory. The Slack and KEK were both thinking that they might build a Super B factory if they didn't build a linear collider. The Americans have said even if they don't build a linear collider, they probably won't build a Super B factory now. I mean, that's, you know, it's a year-to-year thing in the United States. It could change again, but that's
the... Wasn't that supposed to be something at Fermilab?
Yeah, that's the BTEV experiment. And the Americans have canceled the BTEV experiment at Fermilab. That was part of this budget as well. The Americans are putting all the eggs, they're not putting into a rack, into a linear glider basket at this point, I think it's fair to say. Okay, so I wanted to turn now and tell you a little bit about what's going on at Fermilab. This is a picture of the accelerator complex, the high rise with its nice open atrium. It's good to see the architecture regenerating itself in other places. This is the main 6-kilometer tunnel with the superconducting ring in it that runs up to 1 TeV per beam. This photograph was taken to emphasize the main injector. It's actually only 150 GeV normal magnet machine. This was a major upgrade that was done through the late 1990s to provide 10 times as many antiprotons to the Deveron collider. So this is the antiproton target and accumulation source, and the protons circulating in here make antiprotons for us while protons and antiprotons are colliding in the main accelerator, and so that's what allows you to, in principle, get 10 times as many antiprotons as we could in the 1990s when the Fock fork was discovered in Fermilab. 10 times as many antiprotons translates into 10 times as much luminosity, which in turn requires beam spacings that are about 10 times smaller if you don't want to have 10 collisions happening at every beam crossing. And I'll say a little bit more about that in the context of Atlas towards the end of the talk. They were able to run the Tevatron about a degree Kelvin colder, which makes it safe to run up to almost 1 TeV. It's still not exactly 1 TeV, but it's very close, much closer than it was in the previous run. And we now have almost 700 inverse picobarns. This is sort of 6 times as much data as was accumulated in the 1990s when the top quark was discovered. What I'll tell you about today uses about 2 or 3 times as much data. The other half of it has been accumulated in the last year and will start to produce results that will be shown at conferences this summer. This is a picture of the CDF experiment. The tracker had to be completely redone, the silicon tracker and the wire chamber tracker. Canadians had a smaller role to play in the silicon tracker. The forward rapidity region calorimeter was completely replaced. The muon chamber is starting to look a little bit like a Chinese puzzle. There were cracks in CDF muon coverage that have been filled in. And for these higher beam rate crossings, all the front-end electronics had to be upgraded. And this is what happened between 1996 and 2001. I won't say too much about that. What I want to turn to now is some additional physics or some new physics that's coming out, and another way of looking for possible evidence of physics beyond the standard model. Another way of doing this, again, it's perhaps a little bit like what Babar is doing, but perhaps not quite so, is to look at something that shouldn't happen very frequently at all in the standard model and see if you see any evidence for it happening at a much higher rate than you would expect. And the example I've chosen here is neutral B mesons decaying to mu plus mu minus. And so this is the lowest order standard model diagram for that B0 sub S decaying to mu plus mu minus. And because it's a box diagram, well, we know there are no three-level flavor-changing neutral currents. And so because it's a box diagram, if you go through and add up all the CKM phases and look at how this works, it's actually a highly suppressed process. The standard model prediction is about 4 parts in 10 to the minus 9 branching ratio for this. So only about 4 in a billion B sub S's should decay to mu plus mu minus in the standard model. And indeed, only about 1 in 10 billion should decay for B0 to mu plus mu minus. And so the fact that this is a higher rate in B sub S just comes from the higher mass and there's more phase space to produce the W's, but that also, the higher mass makes it more sensitive to other new physics. You can see various things. I guess this can happen in the standard model, but it's a small contribution. But these various other things can happen in the standard model and would require some sort of Suzy extension or some additional particle or some kind of left-right symmetric or Higgs doublet neutrino. These kinds of things can lead to at least 3 orders of magnitude enhancement. As you'll see, that's good because we're sort of about 3 orders of magnitude away from where we would be seeing the standard model rate. But we're starting to sort of clip the tops of the trees on these and rule them out one by one. And indeed, many of these MSSM models This would be enhanced by a large power of tan beta, at least according to this gentleman. And so for high tan beta models, we can start to pick those off as well. Of course, to do this physics, you need a careful analysis of a fairly large data set. This just shows you all of the dimuon decays that we have in CDF. Of course, there's a huge rate. We have tens of millions of, we have tens of millions soon of J psi to mu mu. There are psi primes. We have the upsilon family out here. And of course, what we're looking for is any evidence of real B mesons decaying right around 5 or 5.3 GeV. And you can see we have lots of combinatoric background as well. And in order to understand that, you know, first we have to understand whether we have the efficiencies for these various calibration samples or control samples understood. And then we have to find an efficient way to reject at least all of these guys that are not coming from B meson decay. And the way we do that, sort of four main cuts allow us to get right down to the level of being background free and potentially sensitive to this signal. We cut in a tight mass window around the B or the B sub S meson. It turns out we have about 10 MeV or 9 MeV mass resolution on this, so we can cut quite tightly, and the background of the pure combinatorics now blown up on that scale is of course not related to anything to do with the B meson, so we can get rid of a huge factor of it that way. If it's coming from B mesons, it should fly some distance before decaying. That's what this blue histogram shows. The combinatoric background falls off really quickly. We actually cut somewhere out, it's over here, at about 200 microns. That's 2,000 microns. But we cut somewhere over here, and again, we can get a factor of 10 or even 15 reduction in background. The B meson should fly away from the beam. So when we found the two muons, we could figure out where the B was going, and that should point back to where the beams actually collided. We do that to within a couple of degrees, and all the combinatorics, of course, point in any random direction. So here's the B mesons pointing right back towards the beam line, and here's combinatoric background that doesn't point back to the beam line. Of course, it points somewhere in the beam line because our detector is designed to find tracks that come from the beam line, but not nearly as sharply. And then if it's a real B meson, there shouldn't be much else going on. And so this shows you the fraction of momentum that the B meson carries versus the sum of all the momentum of all tracks in some angular direction. And you can see there's some sensitivity there. It's not factors of 10, but there's a factor of 2 or 3. We do this as a blind analysis. So we tuned up all these cuts by looking at safe sign dimuons and muons that didn't fly in the positive direction but appeared to fly backwards. And we made sure that these cuts were uncorrelated and measured their efficiency before ever actually looking at the data sample between 5.2 and 5.4 GeV. Maybe it's not quite that far. Maybe it's even further out, 4.8 to 5.8 GeV. But once we make all those cuts, turns out we accept up to 2% of all of the beads. It doesn't sound all that impressive, but you've got to remember that we had sort of several tens of millions of combinatoric background events, and we expect to only see one after we've made all those cuts that reject things that don't look like beads. And in fact, here it is. We found the one. It's right at 5.3 GeV, unfortunately. If we look in this 27 MeV mass window, the worst part of it is this one event falls into both the B sub S and the B0 mass window. But still, it's sort of consistent with the background level we'd expect. And so this allows us to set these limits on the branching ratio, that the B sub S to mu mu is less than 6 10 to the minus 7. The B sub D is less than 1.5 10 to the minus 7. Interestingly, you know, these B factory experiments have hundreds of millions of B mesons. And so you'd think they could set a limit like this quite precisely. It turns out, even with this low acceptance times efficiency, we're very competitive in this V0 or light B mode, and we'll presumably get more. They will also get more. As I said before, this mode doesn't constrain the models nearly as well as the B sub S with the higher mass and the more phase space. So this is where you get most of your input in potential models. I got a couple of slides to show what we've done with models, but before I do that, let me just show you where we're going with the Tevatron. This shows the integrated luminosity since about the spring of 2001. What I've shown you there is just data from these early two runs As I say, this will be ready this summer, and this is the data we've started taking just after Christmas this year. On the right here is the progression of instantaneous luminosity. The goal was to get to 10 to the 32, and so we did it precisely once last year, but we've come back on again after Christmas, and we're now sort of running fairly routinely up here around 10 to the 32 instantaneous luminosity. These red dots show you a sort of 20-store rolling average, so you can see when there's something breaks in the machine, the 20-store rolling average starts to fall off and then recovers. And here, when you turn the machine on, the 20-store rolling average takes a while to build up. But you can see that we're sort of averaging 8 or 9, 10 to the 31, which is essentially the design luminosity of the machine now.
Question.
Yeah?
Just curiosity, but what do you mean by combinatorial characteristics we're talking about?
It's just two things that look like muons but didn't come from the same parent particle, the same mother particle. So we can get a pion that can punch through in our detector and look like a muon that happens one time in 1,000, and a real muon from somewhere else. And we try to put those two together and make a B candidate, and one time in 1,000 or one time in 10,000, those two could have a mass of 5 GeV. So it would look like a piece of SW mu, but it wouldn't point back at the origin.
Because combinatorial it just means it's made up of like taking
random pieces of, yeah, that's right. That's what we're after there. And that's what all of these other guys drew here are just these sort of random combinations that look like they satisfy our criteria, at least for triggering and getting into the data set, but they're not real candidates.
You probably said this already, but what's the standard model expectation compared to
It's about 2 orders of magnitude lower, 33 10 to the minus 9, and we're at 5 10 to the minus 7. Factor 200. We're still factor 200 away from the standard model.
So you do limit the parameter space of the
I might have a couple of slides on that. That's what I'll show you in just a minute. So where we're going with this luminosity, we have a set of permanent magnets in the main injector tunnel that I showed you there, where we can store antiprotons. It was called an antiproton recycler. There was some thought initially that we would take the antiprotons out of the collider, coalesce them back into stronger bunches, and re-inject them. We're not actually going to recycle them, but we're actually going to use this ring as extra storage. We're actually successfully using it. And it's probably got us from 7 up to 10, or maybe even slightly more than 10 to the 32. But there is the main program at Fermilab now is to add a co-circulating electron beam along part of the main injector tunnel. And this electron beam actually can cool the antiprotons through electrostatic interactions between the electrons and the antiprotons that co-circulate. And by the end of next year, the hope is that this will give us an additional factor of 2. So we'll get up maybe not to 2 10 to the 32, but close to 2 10 to the 32 in luminosity. And so by doing these two things, we actually look set to double the 700 or 800 inverse picobarns we have now about 3 more times. 2 seems, assuming this works, seems straightforward in the next couple of years. And we're slated to run, even with the recent budget announcements in the US, we're slated to run to the end of the decade and get something like a factor of 40 or 80 times more data than we had in the previous decade, and a factor of 8 or 10 more than we have now.
So the antiprotons were in some sense too hot?
That's the problem, of course. When you make antiprotons for the proton car, you just get a spray of antiprotons. You have to collect them and use a horn and electromagnetic focusing initially. But then you have to circulate them around, and you have to slow down the fast ones and speed up the slow ones to coalesce them into a bunch that you can use to make the collisions. And then by getting a very intense electron bunch all around them, you can actually cause them to coalesce further, and so you can get even more intense bunches. And that's the name of the game, stacking more or producing more antiprotons in the first place, but also collecting them into a useful bunch is what allows us to make the increased luminosity.
That's a process that you can set the energy that you want them to be at.
Yeah, well, the cyclotron sets, the cyclotron sets for the energy. There are magnets that bend it around, and so you know that you want 8 GeV antiprotons, it turns out. But then you've got to get the ones that are 8 plus epsilon and 8 minus epsilon right to 8 so that you make a focused bunch of them. So let me just show you a couple of these slides of what this means. We're not approaching the standard model limit. Our limit is 1.5. 5.5, 10 to the minus 7, and here's the 4, 10 to the minus 9. But we can limit models beyond the standard model. For example, a SUSY SO10 model predicts this massive neutrino. That was the diagram I had in the bottom corner. It's also a possible dark matter candidate. This shows, I cut off the scale on this side, but it shows some SUSY space with the mass of the sporks, and I believe this is the mass of the gluinos on this side. And these dashed lines here show what we could do with various limits. Remember, our limit is 5.5, 10 to the minus 7. So we're ruling out this piece of the phase space up here. Again, it's a very particular model, but we can start to eat into some of these benchmark spaces. Particularly, I think this is one with a large tension beta. Again, that these processes are more susceptible to are more liable to give you a deviation in the B-Sebastian view. So clearly, we're biased in that sense, but there are models of interest nonetheless. And this one is just another one. This is the mass of the sporks versus the mass of the gluino. And I show you this one because now it's on a scale that is more reflective of what we might see at the LHC. Again, it's a high tension beta supersymmetric model. These red regions in the side are excluded on the basis of the various parameters of this particular choice of extension of the standard model. And these black curves here show you what you could reach if you get down to 10 to the minus 7 or 5, 10 to the minus 8. So we're somewhere in here, actually, just above this little corner. Again, you know, the left people actually show graphs that look like this. So this little piece that we've now excluded looks much more impressive. And yeah, the analogy with G minus 2 is there as well. They have the various excursions of G minus 2 that would be allowed by various supersymmetric models on there. The prospects for improving this actually, again, come just a few weeks before Morion and Latwiel. We actually do have a 360 picobarn sample that if we just use the same cuts, at least we would predict a square root n scaling down of our limit. We could predict that we'd get down to 2 or 2.5, 10 to the minus 7. We're actually looking at improving the cuts in order to be less background limited, because you can see already here, if you had 4 times as much data and 4 times as much background, you'd expect to get one or two more perhaps in there. And so you want to try to get a more stringent set of cuts, which would allow you to scale this faster than square root of n, ideally like linear in n. But you could imagine that we'll get down to a few 10 to the minus 7, and I'll show you where that fits in the LHC physics studies in just a minute. So we're starting to make inroads. But again, this is these are indirect searches. If something deviated here, you wouldn't necessarily know what. I hesitated to add a discussion of some of the direct searches that we're doing at the Tevatron. Right now, with 200 or 400 inverse picobarns, they look very much like the direct searches that we did 5 or 8 years ago. But in the next year or two, with a femtobarn or two femtobarns, one could imagine that the direct searches could be much more interesting. As somebody said at Lake Louise the other day, if I had discovered something, then I wouldn't be talking about it here. But maybe in the next year or two, you'll hear more about what we're up to at the Tevatron along those lines. So I just wanted to give you one last example of what we're doing in Canadian and accelerator-based particle physics worldwide, and that's clearly preparations for the ATLAS experiment. As I'm sure most of you are aware, this is the left tunnel just outside Geneva, Switzerland. The Jet d'Eau is there, and the Geneva airport is there. And yeah, there are mountains and skiing and stuff quite nearby. Couldn't help thinking about that when I took off from the plane in Calgary yesterday. And as I'm sure you're also aware, the LHC is well on the way to producing these beams in 2007. There are literally hundreds of these dipole magnets now stacking up everywhere you look at CERN. You worry a little bit that these magnets are now all covered with snow over there at CERN. There have been some slight setbacks in equipping the tunnel, but they're recovering from those, and they soon expect to be putting these underground and preparing the machine to circulate beam. If you go to the CERN website, you can look at a thing called the LHC dashboard. There are sort of dozens of different things that have to be done in order to make the LHC a reality. This just shows one of them, and that's producing the last of the types of superconducting cable that go into those magnets. I suppose I could have shown you where the magnets are. The magnets are about halfway through this process. But the cable, as you can see, has basically all been produced, and most of it has been delivered to the magnet manufacturers. this blue line shows what the contract said the magnet, the cable production schedule would be, and the red line shows when it would be just in time to put it into the magnets and get it underground for machine turn on in 2007. And so you can see that they've managed to meet the just-in-time schedule. You can see why a few years ago people were getting a little bit worried, but over the last couple of years they've been more happy or satisfied with that, and you can see there are sort of month-to-month deviations that keep people at CERN awake at night. But things are progressing quite well, and I think we're on track to have an LHC beam circulating in the next couple of years. These are produced at the manufacturer, and these have been accepted by the manufacturer and accepted by the people who have to make the magnets. So there's some testing that goes on during this time, quality checking and putting them into the process, winding the magnets. So there've been some quality issues. They kept producing them like mad, but they weren't quite up to spec. But somehow they've decided now that they are up to spec. I don't know the details of this particular one, but all of the curves have these sort of two things on Earth, the sort of production and the okay to be used in the next step curve. So this just shows you a cartoon, then again, of Geneva and the lab tunnel. It's not quite the scale, of course. This tunnel at CERN is 100 meters underground, and it's 30 kilometers or 28 kilometers in circumference. This is the CERN main accelerator complex, the injector to the CERN SPS, where the W and Z boson were discovered in the 1980s. What has been added, there's always been an injection line along one direction for protons and for electrons and positrons to be used in the Large Electron Positron Collider at CERN in the 1990s. But they had to add an injection line that goes in the opposite direction, because now the LHC is going to collide protons with protons. And so, in fact, there are two magnetic volumes in the LHC magnets that counter-rotate protons. This gets rid of the problem of having to cool enough antiprotons to make high enough collision rates. You've got lots of protons, but you do have to build a whole other accelerator arm. Of course, for the LHC at the much higher energies, I'm not sure I said this anywhere, but the LHC will run at 70 eV per beam. It's not so important that you have a baryon neutral state. You can collide two protons, and you can still make pretty much anything. At 1 TeV, it's nice to collide a proton and an antiproton, because the baryon number of your initial state is zero, and so you have many more combinations. And indeed, that happens in electron. You want an electron-positron collider to have lepton number zero initial state as well. We don't worry about that so much in the LHC. Just give us a bigger hammer, and we'll make more exciting particles. This is where the Atlas experiment sits. It's just right across the street from the main CERN campus. The CMS guys drew the short straw and had to go 15 kilometers away to the other side of the ring. LHCb is just down near the airport where the Delphi experiment was. So this was my home for 5 or 6 years, as Flip said. And the Atlas experiment is designed mostly to study heavy ion collisions. I won't talk too much more about it. It's actually in the former L3 cavern, which was much bigger than any of the other LEP experiment caverns. But the Atlas and CMS caverns were built specially for the LHC. I'm sure many of you have seen a picture of what the Atlas detector looks like. Again, at first glance, it looks like a traditional collider detector experiment. The protons collide at the center here. There's tracking around it. Then there's calorimeters around that. Then there's this fantastic toroid muon system. These are superconducting coils that actually bend muons to measure their momentum in the outer part of the spectrometer. It looks like any other experiment, except when you try to look at the scale. These little ghostly things down here are people. This is about 40 meters long and 24 meters in diameter, so it's bigger than this whole building, actually. And this piece of it in here is much bigger than even the CDF or other sort of modern-day experiments, and probably is heavier than this building, too. This is just to show you some of the progress. A couple of years ago, this was the cavern just as it was being finished and concreted in. That's the tunnel up there. This is 12 meters, about three stories, down from where the tunnel comes to the floor of the cavern. In 2 years, it's turned into an actual scientific physics installation. You can see this beautifully epoxied floor that you'll never see again. a whole series of scaffoldings. There are ancillary galleries where all the readout electronics will sit. Cables go off down this way, and you can see the feet starting to come in here for the Atlas experiment. This shows you one of these superconducting toroids. They're 25 meters long and about 10 meters or 8 meters across. I have a picture of about 8 Citroëns parked across the front of them in another talk here somewhere. These things are really huge. Just looks like a Tinker Toy or a Lego in there. And you can see them being put down into the feet where they will be held and be bending muons in the next couple of years. The main Canadian contribution to ATLAS was a series of calorimeters, the so-called forward NCAP and very forward calorimeters. This is a photograph of one of the Toronto engineers who designed this installation facility and apparently trusts it with his life because he's prepared to stand under this 5-ton calorimeter. We've been working on the design of these calorimeters and the testing of them since before there was an ATLAS experiment in the early 1990s. Triumph and the University of Victoria in Alberta built about half of these NCAP calorimeters. The other half were built by Russians and Germans. And Toronto and Carleton built 2/3 of these forward calorimeters at very small angles here. The other piece was built by the University of Arizona group in the US. We provided about 4% of the entire capital contribution to ATLAS, is consistent with the people that that we have on the experiment as well. So let me just spend 5 minutes telling you a little bit about where the physics is going to go or come from in this experiment. Of course, the real trick, just as at the Tevatron, is to pull out the interesting physics down here. These are the W and Z boson production cross-sections of order nanobarns, or the Higgs, or very supersymmetric particles, or down lower at femtobarns, from the huge total cross-section up here at millibarns or above. And this is even the BB bar cross-section is only a factor of 10 down from that. And so you see you have an enormous problem. You really need to find some way of pulling out, just as we did in the B sub S to mu mu, pulling a signal out that's 5 or 9 orders of magnitude lower in rate than the total cross-section, total produced cross-section in proton collisions. In order to make any of these very rare processes down here that you probably can't even read, you need a huge collision rates and huge numbers of protons. The LHC collides bunches at every 25 nanoseconds, and not only that, every 25 nanoseconds at full luminosity, 20 or 25 proton collisions will occur simultaneously inside the detector. So that just gives you a sense of how far you have to go up here in order to have any chance of seeing one or 10 or 100 of these guys down here. And in order to get those, then you need a very selective trigger again, just as I talked about with the dimuons for CDF. You need to write something like 1 in a million of these things onto tape to study later. The kinds of things you look for in a trigger are very high energy jets, electrons or muons that would be indicative of a W decay of some sort, displaced vertices that could indicate a B quark, or missing energy, as we'll talk about in a minute, that would indicate some sort of neutrino or perhaps some other standard model, non-standard model process. So this just sort of LHC physics 101. You collide quarks or gluons in the initial proton, producing a gluon. That's 99.9% of what happens, 999% of what happens in the LHC. But then these things, in principle, could couple strongly to some supersymmetric extension of the standard model, say to scalar quarks or scalar gluons. And this is by far the dominant production mechanism, and usually in the simplest models, these things are produced in pairs. Once you have a scalar quark, a spork, or a gluino, then they will tend to decay. And again, if so-called R parity is conserved, if the supersymmetric particles interact in pairs, you'll always have a gluino and a spork like this, and you'll produce some standard model quark. And then a quark, and you'll radiate down to something lower, some other neutralino particle in the Suzy family. But the characteristic of most of these supersymmetric theories is they will eventually decay down to something that's called the lightest supersymmetric particle. And so in this case, it's this high twiddle one. And that Because it's lightest, it can't produce this sort of exchange reaction with normal particles anymore, and so it's left it stable. It will propagate from there, and because it doesn't interact with doesn't have enough energy. If it doesn't have enough energy to have some sort of interaction like this with normal matter, it will tend to escape the detector and leave what we call a missing energy signal. And so we'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. But this too is a good dark matter candidate that one could find.
Was that statement based on just on it being the lightest superparticle, or does it depend upon its mass being less than some other masses?
I think in an R parity, correct me if I'm wrong, I'm not an expert in this, but in an R parity conserving model, once you get to the lightest supersymmetric particle, then you can't have it interact with another the detector won't have any supersymmetric particles flying around in it for it to interact with, and so it will stop interacting and behave like a neutrino. But Lee will correct me.
No. I'm
in a different question.
Okay. So we know that the lightest particle.
No, there are thousands of different variants of parameter space. I think I get the general impression that 80% of them end up this way, but. Maybe Maxim wants to.
Well, if you have a model with a charged LSP, it's not a large model unless it nucleus one if it's a stable model. Because you get a lot of charged
LSP. It's true, it would be pretty easy for us to see a charged particle going through what presumably would ionize, and so we've set limits on them. That's the other thing with all these searches, is it's not what can happen, it's what we can't rule out that is the name of the game.
Right, and let me ask you a general question about supersymmetric searches. How well are you going to be able to actually show that there's supersymmetry that are in these interactions, as opposed to, is it either just some additional particles, some of which couple
I do have a couple of slides on the linear collider. Will you allow me to defer it to then and ask me at the end?
Does that mean that
LHC? Oh no, I don't think that at all. I think there'll be a possibility. I having worked on CDF, I think there is a possibility. What I tried to show you with the B sub S and mu is that we can do sort of spectroscopy that looks for individual states and then describes what's going on with those states, for example, with B sub S. So I think the LHC has some way it can go. I'm not so naive as to believe that we can rule out any possible combination that theories can dream up with supersymmetry with only the LHC, and so I think the linear collider has a role to play there as well.
Well, I'm really asking the obvious question, that is, are you going to be able to prove to a skeptic that the extension of the standard model you discover is supersymmetric?
Depends what one we discover. I think that's the only answer I can give you at this point. So I think the last thing I had on Atlas physics here, and then there's a couple of slides to wrap up, was just what these signals would be expected to look like. So these are Monte Carlo simulations of what's going on. This is some variable, the effective mass of a candidate that's observed. And so we look for this large missing energy that would be a harbinger of a light supersymmetric particle leaving the detector unbalanced. So we do energy momentum conservation and find out that there's 100, 200, or 500 GeV missing, and we say, aha, that was a neutrino, or it was either a very spectacular 500 GeV neutrino, or it was one of these lightest supersymmetric particles. We add to that the energy of the four most energetic jets, because there were all those other quarks being radiated off in that diagram I showed you a minute ago. And if there's a 400 GeV spore per gluino, which we don't know, but we just take that as an example, we'd expect to see something that looks like these dots. And if there's not, if it's just the standard model, we would expect this variable, this effective mass, to be much lower and so much less prominent. And this is what the LHC could do in sort of one sort of tune-up year, maybe not 2007, but 2008 or 2009. At the 400 GeV level of supersymmetry, and this is about as far as at least the LHC people think that we'll get at the Tevatron, but within 100 GeV, I think they're probably right. If instead the quarks and gluinos were at the 1 TeV level, and you ran through this tune-up here, you see it would be much less convincing, and so you might worry that maybe there's something wrong with this background estimate, so it'll be much less conclusive for these higher energy things, but then we'll just run the LHC for more than a couple of years. But the goal here is to have this good hermetic coverage so that you know that you've missed a neutrino or a light supersymmetric particle. So you need this hermetic calorimetry, and the Canadian piece of it was to provide these NCAP calorimeters that actually cover about half of the solid angle, the sort of phase-space invariant solid angle that you'd expect in LHC collisions. So this is one place that Canadians are very active in looking at the physics.
Tevatron reaches about the same time frame as this year we have in the LHC?
Well, we always say at the Tevatron, just as Clio ran for a year or two when the B-factors came on, we'll run the Tevatron for the first year in the LHC, but by the end of that year, presumably, it will be obvious to everyone. You know, that's if all other things being equal and money is infinite. There may be other considerations. And so this is just that line. This is just one more picture. This is the same picture I showed you of Swartz and Gluinos. It might be the other way around, actually, now that I look at it. And this is the picture that the LEP people draw down here in the corner. Here's this piece of SWMU that we already have, in fact, at the Tevatron, and we'll probably end up getting somewhere out to here. But this shows you what the direct searches at the LHC. This is not even a year's worth of low luminosity running. This is a month's worth of low luminosity running. This is a year's worth of low luminosity running. And this is maybe a year's worth of high luminosity running somewhere up here. You see, we expect to get much beyond the 400 GeV or 1 TeV level, which is somewhere here. And presumably, we can keep going.
For our future, Big 10 beta.
This is Big 10 beta still? Yeah, this is 35 in 10 beta.
If you reduce that beta,
still beta. Oh, yeah. No, I mean, all of these things are slices in five-dimensional space. And
I'm saying that compared to the new signal, which was only for large time beta,
right,
this
right.
Will be for private.
You're right. I had this graph I noticed now is a 10 beta of 50, and he overlaid. Whoever I stole this is overlaid it with a 10 beta of 35. So, again, it depends on what model you discover, how well you'll be able to. Of course, to be able to analyze all of this data, we're going to have an enormous computational challenge. The LHC experiments need, you know, tens of thousands of 3 gigahertz processors to actually be able to deal with something like 3 petabytes of data per year. The astronomers always talk about their astronomical catalog and how much data there is in their astronomical catalog. We take that every hour at the LHC, and we do it 24/7, at least 200 days a year. So in order to deal with all this data, we're in the process of setting up the so-called computing grid. This, of course, builds on the success of this other thing that you may have heard of, the World Wide Web. But now, instead of sharing information amongst all computers in the world, we're going to share computation amongst all computers in the world. And this just shows sort of a physicist's first attempt to understand what's going on in the grid these days. This is the LHC grid. Presumably, there's all kinds of things going on in other places. In the world, in Finland and Sweden, in the United States, and Canada is connected to this in a couple of different ways. We have a number of university-based compute centers that are providing their 100, 200, 150 processors to the LHC grid. But we're also in the process of setting up a major, what we call Tier 1 computing center at Triumph. There are going to be a order 10 of these around the world that will be able to analyze something like a quarter or 20% of all the data that the LHC takes. And that's going to be set up at Triumph and run 24/7. And this is going to be a big piece. You know, we did pieces of Babwara grip chamber. We did pieces of CDF, the calorimeters we put into Atlas. The next big high-energy physics investment in Canada is going to be this computing center to be able to deal with this flood of data that's going to come in. And that allows us then to do sort of physics analysis at our home institutions down here at the bottom.
How expensive is that going to be compared to UK this thing?
The Triumph 5-year plan calls for putting $10 million over the next 5 years into this computing center. It only talks about contributing a couple million dollars to the neutrino experiment, for example. But the Triumph 5-year plan put $10 million into the construction of these calorimeters for Atlas already. And there are five times as many people working on Atlas as are working on T2K. So let me just tell you a couple of slides about the future of the IPP program, or Particle Physics in Canada. Clearly, we're heavily invested in Atlas, and there are 20 full-time equivalent people working on it today. And by 5 years from now, or 3 years from now, there'll probably be 30 full-time equivalent people. There is this neutrino beam experiment that I talked about at the beginning, or that I at least mentioned in the table at the beginning. One expects it to grow, but perhaps not quite as much. SNOW is reinventing itself as SNOW Lab, looking for dark matter or double beta decay, but presumably many of the same people who are working on SNOW now. There's a rare kaon decay experiment at Brookhaven that is in some doubt with the recent U.S. budgets, but there's a group of people planning to work on that through the first part of the next decade. And then the thing over the horizon is this linear collider, and I have one more slide on that in just a minute. But there's a fairly large community of people who worked on Opal and Electron projects before. The kinds of things we ask ourselves is, you know, how to balance the sort of large projects, Atlas and Snow Lab, with some smaller ones, and I don't really know what all the smaller ones will be by 2015 at this stage. Are there any projects in the U.S.? And when I wrote this bullet, it was a month ago, and I would have said I hope there'd be one or two, but the Americans are really doing a lot of soul searching. If it's not the linear collider, it may not be anything at all in the way the U.S. budget looks right now. And then I always like to dream, would there be a particle physics experiment that one could actually do in Canada? I guess the answer is yes, there's the Snow Lab experiments. But one thing we are going to be doing over the next year or 18 months is a sort of every 5 years ANSERC sponsors a subatomic physics long-range plan, and they will presumably look at all of these things and give us some sort of wise advice on what we should be doing next. So what's going on with the linear collider? There is a worldwide consensus that the accelerating structure should be made out of superconducting RF. This was pioneered by DAISY and not the technology that was being pushed by SLAC or by the Japanese. But this was chosen as the only reasonable alternative by an international group of wise people, some from each region in the world. So even the Americans agreed that this is the way to go. In fact, an American has agreed to accept the position of design director for the International Linear Collider. They're assembling a team of 12 or 15 people that will make the final designs based on the superconducting RF and prepare a technical design report for sometime towards the end of 2007. And then the idea will be to shop this around to Europeans, Asians, and North Americans. I think it's often called Europeans, Asians, and people from the United States, but I always call them North Americans, to see whether there's anyone who's capable of hosting this thing. It's generally accepted that the host country or host region will provide about half of the funding for this thing, and the other regions would provide 25% each or something. The Germans actually proposed this, got all through this with the German government, and the German government said, yeah, fine, we would do it, we like it, if we only have to pay 20%. And there were no international takers on that level. So now we'll go through this process again with a more realistic, perhaps, starting point. And there are Canadians who are involved in the design of the linear collider. Triumph has been actively involved in studying how the damping rings would work, and there are physicists who've been studying tracking systems and physics for the ILC. So I think I'll just stop there. I think what I was hoping to do was to show you that there are some things that we're doing in accelerator-based particle physics that may have some impact on things beyond the standard model. People always think of what we do as testing this aspect of the standard model or that aspect of the standard model. But hopefully what we'll find is something that actually challenges this paradigm outside the standard model. And I also wanted to show you where Canadians are involved in these, and there are two other projects as well. So leave it there.
I came in a bit late, so you may have addressed this. You talked about things that challenge the paradigm, but I'm somewhat interested in what might confirm it, which is the Higgs. When can we expect, given these upcoming experiments that have come online, when can we expect to know what the mass of the Higgs either is or what it definitely is not?
I think the LHC will have a lot to say about that. We had a sober second look at that in the Tevatron experiments a couple of years ago and concluded it's going to be very hard for us to get into the 120, 130 GeV range to actually say something about it before 2007 or 2008. So I don't think we'll be hearing from the Tevatron experiments. I could be wrong, but I don't think we'll be hearing from the Tevatron experiments. So it'll take a year or two. I mean, there's a whole parallel talk on Higgs stuff that I deliberately tried to avoid because many of my string theory colleagues have said that, you know, Higgs, that's old news. And in fact, even worse, they tell me at Fermilab and at Slack I'm going to Washington next month as a Fermilab user to explain to them why they should be doing particle physics. And they say, don't go and tell them about the Higgs. We've been telling them about the Higgs since before the SSC, and they're all convinced we've already discovered it now. So what you got to do in Washington is you got to go and tell them about dark matter, dark energy, supersymmetric particles and things. And I say, but wait a minute, because if we start telling them about that now, in 2020, they'll be saying, well, haven't you already discovered dark matter or dark energy and understood all these things? So I think what we really got to tell them is that it's a 15 or 20 year business. And by the end of the decade, we may not discover the Higgs, but I think it's clear that the LHC had better tell us something about the electroweak symmetry breaking mechanism, whether it's the Higgs or whatever else it is. And the extent to which you can elucidate which it is will depend on what's there. I mean, I don't have a crystal ball to say 99.9% I'll be able to tell you exactly that it's this SUSY model with these parameters. And so I think in that sense, you do need a linear collider to pin down the models afterwards. But people talk about whether we need a 500 GeV linear collider or 800 GeV linear collider or a 1 TeV linear collider. I think the LHC will have a lot to say about that. It will be much clearer whether, you know, 500 we know how to build today and we could do quite cheaply, but if we discover SUSY particles at 300 or 400 GeV and they have to be produced in pairs, we probably better not build a 500 GeV linear collider.
But I guess I'm just wondering, is this a quick, I mean, is it going to be shortly after turn on, or will it take another couple of years after LHC turns on, or what?
Well, all of these things take a couple of years. There it is. The stuff I showed you from the Tevatron is this stuff, and that's a year and a half ago, right? This is now, and this is about to come out next summer. So everything takes a year. I apologize, but when we're 1,000 people all trying to agree on it, that's about the best we can do. And you know, will it be like this kind of startup, or will it be, you know, straight through the ceiling? It's going to slow down here when it hits my pictures. Oh no, I got right past it here. No, even the big factories, they reach design in 2 years, but it's not. I don't expect the LHC to reach design in the first year or two. So it'll be the end of the decade, I think, before we have this 10 or 30 femtobarns that's needed to really clearly elucidate what's going on.
So what is your design usually?
The LHC?
Yeah.
It's 10 to the 34 inverse seconds, inverse centimeter squared. The 30 femtobarns, that's 10 to the 33. So that's 10% of for 3 years. 10 femtobarns in a year is 10% of the LHC design. 100 femtobarns in a year is the design. And they expect to we'd expect to reach that in 2010, 2 or 3 years after turn on. So that's the sort of ramp up that we expect. But you know, your mileage may vary.
Yeah. I have a sort of general question for how classical physics is learned. So when people started to do experimental gravity, there was a standard model which is general relativity, and there were lots of different alternative, you know, post-generality theories that people proposed. So the theories had together and made a kind of standard post-standard model, mm-hmm. which was called the post-Newtonian parameterization. Mm-hmm. And they identified a set of parameters that were model-independent that experimentalists would try to measure to tell you whether it was a standard model, like GR or something else.
Mm-hmm.
And just as an outsider, the thing that I find disturbing is that post-standard model seems to be a symmetric standard model, which has millions of parameters in it. Being complicated. Is there a need for something like a theory-independent generic parameterization?
I'm just looking for my options here. They're here somewhere, I'm sure.
You understand?
Yeah, no, I do. I mean, there is the minimal supersymmetric model that tries to get rid of the 140 different options. Then there are other variants, SO10 and minimal supergravity and things like that. So I think there's a handful of.
I guess the question is that if it's not supergravity, and you're losing energy for super symmetry, you're losing energy.
I mean, from an experimentalist point of view, it's a search for missing energy, and it's ensuring that the detector is not lopsided or missing a big chunk of it or something. But in terms of how to pin down this parameter space, it's still not as well controlled as one might perhaps like. It's a bit chaotic.
I mean, is there a need for theorists to make something like a post-Newtonian parameterization?
The closest analog to that would be when you take all the effective operators in the higher and higher dimension, and that comparison to them, the analysis data in terms of those operators that's been done, it doesn't tell you much yet because you're always some circle around the standard model, but if you see something, then it's more interesting to get into the
Right, and then the thing that I'm worried about is the thing where something is seen as consistent with one of the 12 different scenarios that we get when it was the symmetric standard model. So half the theorists would never get down saying supersymmetry has been discovered, but actually no supersymmetry has not been proven by measurement, the way say, you know, flavor symmetries are proven by actually measuring.
Right. No, I agree. We're gonna have to do the spectroscopy and see more than just one lighter supersymmetric particle before we can start to build the hierarchy and flesh out. No, that the good news about supersymmetry is that half of the particles have been found, right? And I think one more of them won't
work. The question I'm really asking is it seems like there will be experimentally a big lag between when there is missing energy found and when there's a good case that it's actually supersymmetric as opposed to some non supersymmetric energy.
I'm not sure I agree with that because, Babar and Bell have shown that once they start to see CP phases in some place, then they're studying all the other places they could be. So, you know, there are 1,000 people, and not many of them are sitting on their hands. Market forces are at work to try to be the first to discover the first one, but then there'll be 10 more if they're there that will be found quite quickly. And so I think it'll be possible. Once we have 30, what dictates that is having 10, 30, or 100 in respective barns of data available for these 500 country postdocs.
Well, what it really means is that if you see some bunch of particles, it's not suited yet, because masses of these particles are not predicted.
You'll need the decay.
You'll
need the decay.
Right, right parallel would be not the deep physics, but Telescope, where how well do we know the couplings of T-coordinate?
We know what orbiting 0 and 1.
No, I agree with you.
It's virtually certain that somebody came up with a non-supersymmetric model that explains the missing energy. It's the couplings.
Yeah, no, the branching ratios, we'll have to go through and do all of that. But once, and it won't be 1 or 2 or 3, you'll need 10 or 15 or 20 to understand the interrelationships. But then it won't be possible to say it's just this one. It's only possible to rule out. That's the way physics works, right? You're only able to rule out the ones that you know it's not. You can never be sure it's the one that it is.
Well, this would actually follow this specific because it's telling me that supersymmetry is breaking the theorem. But if it doesn't, what's the need? Then it's some of the irrationals to prove. How is this reasonable for the promoting?
Well, so my only comment to that is that the breaking point for me in 1996 when I left CERN and moved back to North America to work on CDF was when my left colleague said that the minimal supersymmetric lightest Higgs would be no more than 10 GeV above the Z mass, and so it was a lead type cinch that you would see it at left 2. And then they said, except for this small problem that maybe the scalar quarks and gluminos might be 1 or 2 or 3 TeV, and then the radiative corrections would make it run up from 100 GeV to 120 GeV, where they admitted they wouldn't see it. So that's where we are now. I think I won that bet, I mean, by default or not. There's always ways to fix, as you say, supersymmetry to break it at 10 TeV would be much less useful. Or
the Planck mass.
Well, 10 TeV or the Planck mass is the same, as I understand it. So.
Yeah, another thing that's going to generate a huge amount of data is LIGO and the other gravitational wave detectors. So is this computing grid that you talked about related to them? Will this establish some sort of links between the gravitational observers and the particle physicists?
Now, I was thinking about that when I was putting together this slide. I was actually at CERN in 92, 93, 94. And this guy down the hall told me, you know, I couldn't look at my histograms online anymore by just looking at them, by logging into the computer. No, I had to do it with this HTML web page thing. And I said, what a load of rubbish that is. And if nobody will ever use this, and I went away from CERN in 96, it still wasn't the World Wide Web. And now it is. The grid is certainly envisaged for people to do genomics and astronomy and gravity. So I don't know that this will necessarily foster closer ties. To the extent that high energy physics and airlines to foster closer ties with the internet. You know, it will foster closer ties with everything. But I don't think it's specifically for gravity versus astronomy versus genomics. The vision that many places have now is this is for all kinds of research and is a thing we must do. At this stage, it's for running a SETI at home, right? That's what it does really well, search for extraterrestrial intelligence. But that's the same mindset I had 10 years ago at CERN. What a stupid thing. It's a real pain to run your computer this way. You're not even allowed to use your computer anymore because you have to go to the grid and ask if you can use your computer. But I suspect they'll work the bugs out and it'll be have much wider applications than just gravity. But it's certainly available to both communities.
Canadian is really available.
What's that?
Will we have LHC at home?
I don't know. There are lots of outreach activities that we're trying to put together to give people an insight into what we're doing. So maybe.
But the data would be publicly released, or is there one project you got?
Many of the lab experiments and some of the Tevatron Run 1 data is now available on the web. If you want to go and run a search for something that we didn't think of, and the Run 1 data. You can use the Run 1 data. We do that on the basis that the Run 2 data will allow us to cross-check it if somebody discovers something quite quickly. But there are movements to do outreach like that based on NASA's success with outreach. I haven't heard about the gravity wave detectors will never put their data.
There is like one line.
You can imagine, though, that we want to keep enough data so that we can figure out what's going on if somebody claims we really did miss something. And so I don't know how long it would be that exactly.
Thank you. I believe it wasn't for a certain level.